You're watching Network Radio. Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Having just endured a biopsy of my nose, I thought I'd spare the visual image. So you're seeing a picture of me instead of my countenance. But I'm very, very pleased to have with me today Kelly Watt, who's been an astute student of Sandy Hook and done brilliant work, including spotting the blue moving pad beneath the bed of Nancy Lanza, which in their haste they forgot to remove. Kelly was on top of that because she has her own commercial and home moving company. And it's a real pleasure to have you here, Kelly. Thanks so much for joining me tonight.
Thanks, Jim. But don't forget, we also found the blue moving pad in Adam Lanza's bedroom, too.
That's right, Kelly. You made a lot of great finds. Tonight, we're going to talk about research Kelly's been doing to try to nail down the identity or the what has become of Noah Posner. We know he didn't die at Sandy Hook. And Kelly has had more contact with his presumptive father, Lenny, whose real name appears to be Leonid P. Osner, where he conflated his middle initial with his actual last name to create the image of Lenny Posner. Here in slide one, you see one of Lenny's first outings in attacking the Sandy Hook truth research community. Our grief denied the twisted cruelty of Sandy Hook hoaxers, which appeared in the Hartford Courant, but it's only one of many. Now, one of the reasons why Noah Posner has turned out to be so terribly, terribly interesting is because not only is he alleged to have died in Newtown on 14 December 2012, but as the next slide shows, he's also supposed to have died in Pakistan on 16 December 2014. This makes him a highly unusual young man. But notice the photos, to the left of the woman at the top and toward the middle of the banner at the top of the lower portion. Moreover, during her 100 hours of conversation with Lenny, Kelly told him again and again and again, she didn't believe him. She didn't think he had a son. He certainly didn't have a son who died. It would be good if he could send her some proof. And what we see in slide number three is actually a death certificate that Lenny sent to Kelly, which, of course, as those who have studied the case well know, is a fabrication. Notice the difference in the text between about 10 lines down and the rest of the bottom. We actually have a signature of no less a figure than H. Wayne Carver, MD, the medical examiner. But look at the top. There's no file number. That means this is preposterous. It's not bona fide. Notice at the top right, actual estimated time of death, 11 a.m. Well, the shooting took place from 9:30 to 9:35. So it's wildly inaccurate. And if you study the fonts, you'll see there's several different fonts that were used putting this together. It's a fabrication. But it's very obvious that if Noah had actually died, Lenny would not have had to fake it. Kelly?
Yes.
Just elaborate on how you were able to talk Lenny into sending this.
Well, it just came about one night. I said, in order for, I'd need to see some substantiating documents. And I asked for a school report card, and which let's see, it was either on this death certificate or it was on the report card where they spelled the name of the street wrong. They spelled Dickinson wrong. And I also asked for some of the death certificate, and I said I needed a picture of his wife, who is now his ex-wife. I needed a picture of her in the hospital holding the twins, Noah and his sister, Ariel. And he did send a photo of her holding the twins, but it wasn't one in the hospital.
Well, Kelly, I got to say, I think you've been wonderful in dealing with Lenny. And I know that in spite of all your badgering, all your denials of his position, what he was asserting, he only terminated his conversation with you when you suggested to him he was in it for the money. Did you hit a sore point?
Yes, I did. I asked him for the name of the official website, donation page site for his son, and told him that I was going to make a donation because I really felt in the future that there would be a lawsuit regarding these fraudulent funds. And so he said, why, you know, he asked me, why would you want the name of the organization and the website? Because you don't even believe I have a son that died. And when I told him that I thought there might be a future lawsuit, he ended our 3 months worth of conversation by using some expletives, and that was that.
So he wasn't nice. He, right up to the end, he became very nasty and hostile.
Over that, up until then, yeah, I would kind of consider him a good, you know, telephone friend.
Well, because, of course, you know, it's my conjecture that the reason Lenny has become so aggressive in attacking James Tracy is that given the fraudulent death certificate, given that Noah had been reported to have died not only in Newtown but in Pakistan, James was seeking to determine whether Lenny had any legitimate copyright claim to be made in relation to the photographs of Noah. We'll talk more about photographs and copyright claims, but let me just add that if you look at the next slide, number 4, you'll see that Lenny has continued to write attacks, very nasty attacks about James Tracy. This one, Chance, if you could give us the next slide, was published in the Sun Sentinel, a South Florida newspaper that's published a whole lot. And notice here, you know, all the emotional appeals. It's been 3 years since he last embraced our precious little boy, Noah. At 6 years old, he was the youngest child murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary School. While our family may have managed to live through this tragedy, the passage of time is nowhere near dimmed the vivid memory of that day, nor made it any less difficult for us to cope with the pain and anguish of losing our only son. To say this is rubbish is to put it very mildly, Kelly. This is complete nonsense. This is utterly false. It's calculated to play on the emotions of those who are naive and have never studied Sandy Hook, who do not know that the school was closed by 2008, that there were no children there, and therefore no one for Adam Lanza to have shot, including Noah Posner, and that it was done to promote gun control by the Obama administration. I mean, what he's been publishing, Kelly, is to me completely outrageous and unconscionable.
Well, Jim, where it says that he has pain and anguish of losing their only son. Well, let me remind, he does have a stepson named Michael Babner. And he also, if he has so much pain and anguish of losing his only son, then why didn't he show that pain and anguish to me? Why didn't he show, you know, after 3 months, I, you know, left this with, I don't think that he had a son that died at Sandy Hook. And why would he continue to talk to me that many hours, that many times, email me and all of this, when I'm telling him on a daily basis that I don't believe his story, and he didn't show any pain and anguish then, he continued to call me.
Yeah, I think you make very telling points. And, of course, other parents didn't show any pain or suffering at the time. Robbie Parker being a famous case. Lynn McDowell being another. She was on Anderson Cooper all dolled up, flirting with Anderson Cooper. No signs of grief. Robbie Parker came out for a press conference all jocular, smiling, laughing. When he saw the assembled press, he stopped, hyperventilated to get into character, and then went on to talk about the loss of his daughter, Emily, but had the foresight to mention his donation page. It's simply obscene. Here in the next slide, number 5, we see that the major media have now become instruments of propaganda and disinformation for the administration in relation to Sandy Hook. I have published three blogs recently, this Thursday, January 7th, proof the New York Times publishes Sandy Hook disinformation and propaganda, quite blatant. This was authored by the Miami bureau chief of the New York Times, Lizette Alvarez, and she mentions, she actually gives a link to the Sandy Hook Facebook page where James Tracy lays out why his actions have been directed at protecting the public interest, but there's no explanation of the two reported deaths, of the fabricated death certificate, that Lenny has $1 million in donations, and he's worried that if the hoax is exposed, he may have to give the money back and might even be prosecuted for fraud. Here's a second article on slide number 5, showing that the Washington Post has joined in the fray. And, of course, the Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos, who also owns Amazon.com, which banned the book less than a month after it had been published on 22 October. By 19 November, when it had sold nearly 500 copies, I think they were worried it would become a runaway bestseller. Jake Harney, who had been a White House spokesman, had gone to Amazon.com as senior vice president, and they took the move of suppressing the book, never imagining I would take the action I did, which was to release it to the public for free as a PDF, where anyone who's unaware of that can go to rents.com, and right on the homepage there, scroll down about a quarter of the way, you'll find where you can link to the PDF and download it for yourself. And now, as the next slide shows, number 7, even the Chronicle of Higher Education has buckled to the official account. One of the most scurrilous articles I've ever read in my life appeared in none other than the Chronicle of Higher Education, authored by one Kevin Carey. It shows absolutely no knowledge whatsoever of the facts of the case. It's completely corrupt and grossly unethical in its conception. I published a very strenuous response to this that was quite lengthy, which the Chronicle has refused to publish. They seem to have frozen the website. I would like to believe, under the most charitable interpretation, that they are going to do research to determine the right and the wrong about what they were publishing here, which was complete and total rubbish. Now, Kelly, because you've been doing so much research on these photographs, I thought I'd bring up points as shown in the next slide, number 8, about copyright, because in fact there are exceptions to copyright that includes commentary, searchisms, criticism, parody, news reporting, research, teaching, library archiving, and scholarship. Those are all justifications for violating what is normally considered to be a copyright prerogative. But here you're doing research. We're doing criticism. We're trying to solve the biggest hoax maybe in the history of the United States, minus the moon landing on the one hand and the cover-up and the death of JFK. And I suppose we should throw in the phony story we've been given about 9/11. It turns out the government's lying to us on the right and left. But I'm so fascinated by what you've been doing, Kelly, in pursuing the what has happened to Noah Pauser. I mean, if he grew up and he didn't die in Sandy Hook and he didn't die in Pakistan, then he must be somewhere. So I want you to know, I believe that your research falls clearly within the exceptions of copyright provision, Kelly. And I want you to begin now with your slide set, which is quite extensive and utterly fascinating. Let's go to slide number 9. Kelly.
Okay. I just went through a bunch of images that I found online that anybody can search for themselves on Google. And I also got a lot of the images off of the Noah Memorial Facebook page. And but this image came off of Google. And a lot of these pictures I started noticing, I thought it was a little bit disproportionate that I see so many pictures of Noah. In this picture, he's with his older sister, Sophia. Let me back up and just say that Noah had a twin sister who did not die at Sandy Hook. She was in another classroom, and she was his twin, and her name's Ariel. In this photo, he's with Sophia, who I believe was in the fourth grade at Sandy Hook. And she didn't die either. And then he's got two stepsisters. He's got two step.
You mean, Kelly, officially, because there were no children at Sandy Hook.
Right. This is the if you believe the official story, okay, this is what you're to believe. And then he's got a stepsister who is, her name's Danielle, and she is about 19 or 20. She was a writer for USA Today. And he also has a stepbrother named Michael Vabner. And they were by Noah's mother, by a previous husband, by her first husband. And his name was Mr. Vabner. So in other words, in the family, there should be Lenny, Veronique, Michael Vabner, Danielle Vabner, and there should be Noah, Ariel, and Sophia. That's seven people in the family. And when I went through all these images, I've been through so many images, and I have not found any of the whole family together, you know, all seven people at a Hanukkah or, you know, there's no pictures.
A birthday or a reunion or whatever. Kelly, that's very peculiar, don't you think?
Right, and there's no pictures of them in the hospital when these twins are born. You know, you think maybe the stepbrother and sister would have been in the hospital room. I mean, there's just not the typical family photos anywhere of holidays or anything of all seven of them together. Okay.
Let's go right ahead and just tell Chance to proceed to the next slide.
Okay, so anyway, what I want to bring out in that picture was that they're on the beach and he's in shorts and she's in a bathing suit. Okay, next slide. Okay, this is really distorted. It's not this bad on Google.
Could be when I loaded it for a slide, you get some aspect ratio, you know, compression. I could adjust it, but
That's okay. What I want you to see in this picture is this is Sophia sitting on her dad's lap, Lenny Posner, or Len P. Osner. And then sitting next to him is Noah, and then Veronique, and then the little twin girl, Ariel. And if you'll notice, they all have on short sleeve shirts again. And my point in this and these slides are to show you, you know, I always thought it was kind of cold in Connecticut, and it's disproportionate the amount of summer clothes that these kids, it's like, my question is, are they from Connecticut or are they living in Florida? Because so many of the photos that we're going to see tonight, I want you to notice their wardrobes, and they're either on the beach, they're in water, they're in a swimming pool, they've got on bathing suits, life jackets, they're in inner tubes. I'm just not understanding why all these.
You know, that's interesting, Kelly, because I lived in Florida. We lived there for nearly 5 years in Sarasota, Bradenton, and I practically lived in a swimsuit in Florida, but that wouldn't be typical of other locales where the weather is far more seasonal. In Florida, you can do that because it's so constant and pleasant.
Right, and keep in mind that Lenny lives in Florida now.
That's right. So how
long has he lived in Florida, and was he in Florida during the Sandy Hook? Are these kids really from Florida?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that this is, you know, I don't know. Nobody knows for sure. This is just another line of questioning that we need to look at as we try to solve this mystery. You know, it's just another avenue to go, you know, okay?
Right.
Okay, next slide, Chance. Okay, again, short sleeve shirts. And then the picture on the left, they're at an aquarium, and he's got on little sandals and a little camouflage shorts and little camouflage shirt.
And now, is this supposed to be his twin sister?
Yes, this is his twin sister. And then on the right, again, short sleeve shirt. Next slide. We've got on a life jacket here with the t-shirt. And I really can't tell what that is in the background.
Well, there are a lot of waterways in Florida. I mean, that appears to be some kind of, you know, mossed over lane for water traffic. I mean, that's what that appears to be to me.
Yeah, it's hard to, it's really hard to say. But anyway, the life jacket again. Next slide. Okay, this is a birthday and short sleeve shirts again. Next slide. There's no trees. There's no leaves on the trees. So that could be fall.
Now look at the age of Lenny here in relation to pictures that you would believe are more recent vintage. Making some calculations about age and the differences in age. This is obviously a very young Noah.
Yes. And if you look at the pictures in the background, you'll see there's no leaves on the trees. So I'm saying this is fall or winter. And again, t-shirts, the dad's got on a t-shirt. You know, it's just, I don't know. It's just really strange. And also I kind of want you to notice, I'm going to point out in pictures too, I want you to keep track of Noah's hair. And has, when he's a little boy, you can see that he does have naturally curly hair, at least when he was little. I don't know at what point it got straight, but he was born with naturally curly hair, which is going to become important later on in the slideshow. Okay, next slide, Chance. Okay, here we go again. Short sleeve shirt and flowers. So maybe this is summertime. I don't know. He does have on pants in this picture. This is one of the rare photos where he has on, you know, pants.
They seem to be so addicted to these pictures of Noah at roughly this age because he was such an adorable and photogenic young man. But when you look at him older, and it does appear to me that the photos you have are of Noah older, he's lost that charming look that he had that made him so valuable for commercials and the like.
Right. And yes, you're really drawn to him because he was a cute little boy. And the picture on the far right where he's in the green and black shirt.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have a better picture just of that later on or not. But if you don't, that might be the only chance we get to look at that. But as you can see, he had naturally curly hair. And the picture
there does seem to fall in a different way than in the central photograph, the center photograph.
Right.
That's how it comes forward. It's not coming forward in the right-hand photograph. Is that Noah on the right?
Supposed to be. And then another thing I've noticed in all these photos that I've looked at, there's very, very few photos that have any identifying features in the background. It's like they've all been cropped just enough that you can't do research with background information to find out, you know, when that picture was taken. It's really strange. Every picture has been cropped just at the right place. Okay, next slide. Okay, another little t-shirt. And he's got straight hair. And, you know, I have to give it to him. He is a cute little boy. Next slide. A little short sleeve Oshkosh shirt.
And what? Yeah, tell me, what is that shirt? I want to know more about it.
Oshkosh, by gosh. That's just another little short sleeve shirt. And it looks like he's got a big cowlick on the right side of his head. Okay, next photo. Now he doesn't have on any shirt. So I don't know where this was taken, but, you know, now he's shirtless.
It is very curious, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Another thing I want you to take note of are his lips. Okay. Notice how his lips really turn up on the corners, and he's got a very pronounced angel bow in his lip, on his upper lip, very, very pronounced. And keep your eyes on the color of his eyes, because that's going to be important later in the slideshow too.
They look green to me.
Well, I think we'll see some more pictures of his green eyes. Next slide. Okay, so here we are again. There's some leaves not on the trees in the background, and we've got on short sleeve shirt again. And notice the mouth on the right-hand side. Notice how it goes up, you know, on the corners. And notice his left eye. As you're looking at the photo, his left eye slightly slopes downward. Okay, keep that in mind too. The slightward
as we're looking at him, his left eye.
Look at his left eye. No, his left eye. Notice how it kind of on the.
But Kelly, looking at that photograph, his left eye is on the right.
As we're looking at the photo.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Look, as you're looking at the photo, it's his right eye, but our left eye. Okay. As we're looking at it. All right. Next photo. Another t-shirt.
A lovely picture of Veronique.
Yes, that's his mother. And to me, I don't know, she just seems a little bit old to have a little six-year-old.
So this could be her at an older age juxtaposed with Noah at a younger age.
No, this is, I think, a fairly recent photo of her.
Yeah, but of her, yes. But I'm saying of Noah, that photograph would be when Noah was much younger.
Right, right.
And where do we get this drawing of Noah as a little angel?
I don't know. Somebody just...
Is that a Jewish thing to have Noah drawn as a little angel?
You know, no telling who did that. Okay, next slide. This is Noah and Ariel. And short sleeve and a sleeveless dress. And he's in a short sleeve shirt again.
And there's that same diagram of him as an angel on the left.
They are inside wherever they are at this picture. Okay, next slide. Okay, again, no shirt. And notice his lips, how they curl up on the edge. Notice the eye on the left, or his right eye, again, going downward.
Yeah.
Okay, this will be important later. Okay, look at his upper lip. Really good. All right, next slide. Now he's barefooted and in shorts. They're all barefooted and in shorts. And Ariel's in a sleeveless dress and Lenny's in shorts. And, of course, they are inside. So, you know, maybe it's summer in Connecticut. I don't know. My point is, as I was looking through these, it just seemed disproportionate, the amount of clothes that are on these kids on the internet. Compared to the pictures, I only saw like two pictures of them in the snow with gloves and hats on and parkas. I might have seen one picture of him lighting a Hanukkah candle, but I just don't see family photos at Hanukkah, Halloween,
birthdays.
No, I did see a video. There is a video on the Noah Memorial Facebook page, and they are gathered around, and he was born, I think, November 6th, and he is, they're blowing up a birthday cake candles, but there's candy canes on the candles, on the cake, which I thought was kind of strange to have candy canes if they're celebrating their birthday. And then I'm listening to them as they sing Happy Birthday, and they sing Happy Birthday, dear, and then they say, Noah, and I cannot hear them saying Ariel, which I thought was kind of strange.
Yeah, if he's a twin sister, was born on the same date.
Right. But they are both sitting there in front of the birthday cake. So I do have to, you know.
That is kind of odd. Maybe they're trying to suppress the fact that Ariel exists.
Well, I don't know. And maybe they are saying Ariel. I just couldn't make it out. And so I, you know, I could be wrong on that. So if anybody wants to go to the Noah Facebook, Memorial Facebook page, scroll down, it'll be on the left-hand side under videos, and watch it and see if you can make out the word Ariel when they sing Happy Birthday. Okay, again, in swimming somewhere, in a swimming pool, obviously, or a hot tub. Looks like a hot tub.
Or a jacuzzi, yeah.
Okay, and here are the twins again. In his little Angry Bird t-shirt.
So are they, of course, since one's male and one's female, they can't be identical, but they're very close, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with differences that you'd expect would characterize a little girl versus a little boy.
Right. Okay, next photo. Okay, this is, you know, this is getting close to the whole family, but the older kids are missing. Again, shorts, tennis shoes. Okay, if wherever they are, it's warm. Okay, next photo. Okay, now this is the older brother. This is the stepbrother, and his name's Michael Babner. All right.
It looks to me as though this could be Lenny older by a considerable margin. I mean, you know, as he matured and his features became somewhat different and solidified.
You mean Noah?
Noah, of course, okay. Yeah.
So, well, this is what I'm going to get to at the end, because Noah may be Michael Babner. And as we scroll down, I think we might be able to see that. So next photo, Chance. Okay, here. Hey, look, he's got on a Spider-Man outfit. When he grew up, he liked Superman. Okay, anyway, he's in his little Spider-Man t-shirt. She's again in a sleeveless dress, so it's warm somewhere, and the person in the background's got on their shorts. So again, it's just disproportionate. There's no cold weather pictures when they live in Connecticut. Okay, next slide. Look, okay, he likes Spider-Man. That's Noah as the
made up as Spider-Man.
Made up as Spider-Man. I guess once a superhero lover, always a superhero lover. If that indeed was Noah grown up a few slides back, standing next to the Superman costume. But that's totally speculative.
Well, it's not totally speculative, Kelly, because you're presenting a whole lot of photographs that give rise to the possibility, even presumption, that may very well be Noah at his something closer to his current age.
Right, maybe. Okay, next slide.
Well, as you've observed, you got to be somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I just took this slide to show you that this came out of the Jewish Week, what you're getting ready to see. It came out of the JewishWeek.com website. So next slide. Okay, and this is what came out of there. It says that Veronique Posner remembered her son Noah as a rambunctious, video game loving little man, a boy with a perpetual smile and twinkly blue eyes. Next slide.
Wait a minute. How can he now have blue eyes? Go back, Chance, to the earlier slide. How can he have blue eyes, Kelly, when we've seen that he appears to have green eyes? What's going on here?
I don't know. I think there's another picture. I hope you've included it, that I found on his grandmother's blog site. She has a bread baking blog site, and I hope you have that picture.
I have all the pictures you sent me, with one exception, which was a bit of a redundancy.
Okay.
But all the rest are here, Kelly. They're all here.
All right. Well, just keep in mind.
You got 20 more photographs or slides to go.
Okay. So just remember that Veronique, his mother, saying that he has twinkly blue eyes. Now then, this is the off of his grandmother's blog page. And the grandmother saying, like me, Danielle had no words left on the day of the funeral. Keep in mind, Danielle is the stepsister, the older stepsister, who's like 17 or 18 or 19. And then she says in the second paragraph, it says, let's see. His beautiful blue eyes, alight with mischief. All right, so keep that in mind. Next slide. I think that might have just been.
I think this was a continuation, Kelly. It was so long. I broke it into two slides.
Okay, wait, no, I included that one because in the next to the last paragraph, it says he loves superheroes and Star Wars and all of the things little boys love.
Yeah.
He loves superheroes. Does he still love superheroes today? Next slide.
No, Chance. You jumped over about 10 of them. Huh. Kelly, we seem to have lost several by the transition between whatever your computer and Chance's computer aren't playing them the same way.
Well, let's just go down and hopefully the ones that I'm really wanting this whole program to be about, hopefully they're at the bottom. So let's just keep going. That's all we can do. This is the, just so your listeners can see, this is the Noah Posner Memorial Facebook page.
And the eyes seem to me to be green rather than blue. How can his parents be misdescribing the color of his eyes?
You've got me there, Jim. Your guess is as good as mine. Okay, next slide. Okay, we're in the water again. Next slide. We're on the beach. Next slide. We're on the beach on another day. Next slide. We're at the ocean. Next slide. Look, they're finally in a parka and gloves and hats. Maybe they're in Connecticut.
You'd think there'd be a whole lot more photographs
maybe,
like
that. Maybe they're visiting somebody in Connecticut.
Yeah, visiting.
Right. So next slide. Okay, this is Danielle and Michael Vabner, and I'm not sure who the other graduate in the white is. I thought it might have been Sophia, the other Noah's fourth grade sister, maybe all grown up.
Now, look at the smile there. That seems to be Noah's smile, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, he looks an awful lot like Noah, and she looks like she could be Ariel. Ariel and Danielle, even their names kind of sound alike. But anyway, now they've got curly hair, but he is a dead ringer for Noah, and hopefully you're going to see that in a minute. So next slide. Okay, this was in an article in the Forward, the Jewish Forward magazine, and it says Noah Posner's family remembers and mourns. And here it says Noah was an energetic leg of the tripod, an animated boy with big blue eyes. Next slide.
I think that's the last one, Kelly. We have to go back to see if any of those will show that weren't showing before. I'm very, very troubled that some of the ones you most wanted to talk about are missing in action.
What happened to those?
What, do we have at least five of them?
That is really, really strange.
Champs, how many are not playing? At least 10 of them that aren't playing? What can account for that? It says quick time and a decompressor are needed to see this picture. Yeah, let me see if I can't do that. Kelly, you keep talking about your experience with Lenny.
Well, I might be able to get him one faster.
Okay, so right to chance, yeah.
Okay. I don't have his email address.
Blog at webookyourshow.com.
Here comes the hate mail.
You think there's going to be hate mail?
No. I usually post a different one, but I don't care. I love
blog
it.
At we do your show.
We book your show.
Oh, we book your show. Okay, hold on.
Yeah, because we got 20 minutes, so even if it takes you five more minutes to get them to chance, we got time to talk about them.
Right. I just got to figure out how to send. I'm not technological savvy at all, so.
Well, just do a forward on.
Well, okay. I sent one, but I'm going to try to send more in the next email, a bunch together. So. This is embarrassing. Send. see here. Okay, so I want that photo. And I want... These aren't going to be in as good as order as I want them in, but...
That's okay. If we can just get them up, that's fine.
Right, right. Okay, hold on just a sec. I want to get some pictures of the quote, green eyes here. Okay, oh, this is one for sure.
I think I found a bunch of them.
What was that website we went to?
Well, you tell Kelly what it is and she can talk about it. That my I see them as unimportant.
Wait, I'm not seeing the website. So it's called We Book Your Show? Because it said invalid address. So let me do it again. WeBookYourShow.com? Mm-hmm. Oh, blog. Do I put blog first?
Yeah, blog. Yeah, We Book Your Show.
Okay. I left off the word blog.
Kelly, Chance, I just sent you a bunch that I think are some of the ones she most wants. You see the one with the older Noah and then just the eyes and then the shoes and so forth? These are a whole bunch of the eyes that I've just sent you.
Okay, I think you got mine too. You might just look and see if there's any.
What about the set I sent, Chance, if you can pull them out of there? Trouble being they're not in there as attachments.
Chance, I don't mean to confuse you, but if you got my email, no, the second one. Okay, those are the ones that really are important. Okay, so just look at, yes, and he's got on a black and white shirt. Okay, I want you to take a really close look at his lips. And again, if you're looking at him, look at his left eye and how it kind of slopes down a little bit. That's very important. Okay, you notice his eyes are green. Okay, what's the next photo? Oh, okay.
Kelly, why don't you talk about your experience with Lenny and your assessment of the man?
Well, I just, talking to him for as long as I talked to him, there was an article in The Trace, which was a new publication that's come out, and they totally lied. They said that... I pursued him on Google Plus, but it was actually quite the opposite. I got an email one day, and it's Google Plus, and I opened up my email, and it says that Lenny Posner is following you on Google Plus. So I hit the reply button, and I put, why are you following me? Is it because I don't believe a word that you're saying, and I don't believe that anybody died at Sandy Hook? And that's how we started talking, and we emailed back and forth for several hours, and then he said, I'm really getting tired of typing. Can we talk on the phone? And I said, well, you call me because I don't want to call you and say I'm harassing you or anything like that. So he called me. And
very smart of you, by the way.
Yeah, so that's how we got to talking. And You know, and then one night he did have a really good sense of humor. Oh, he did tell me that nobody had autopsies, that they just did what was called a visual autopsy. And I said, well, I've never heard of that. And I even looked it up and couldn't find anything. And I said, what's a visual autopsy? And he said, that's just where they look at them. They just looked at them. Who's smiling? Oh, okay. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to my sent mail. Okay. Okay, so, oh, you mean Michael Vabner? And it's kind of dark? Okay, yes, that's Michael and his sister. And so that's a fairly recent picture of them. And then the next picture of just him is on a black background. It's just kind of a same photo, just of him, a little bit closer up. Okay, and the next photo, are you showing the one of just Noah with the green eyes? Yes, that's Michael and Danielle. And so, okay, and so the next photo, do you have one of Noah? Just the eyes? No, that's not Noah. Well, that's Michael. You mean the older boy? Yeah, that's Michael. But I'm wondering, is that really Noah? Now, if you go to the next slide of him in the life jacket and look at the lips and look at the how the corners of his mouth turn up.
Chance, you can see him and I can't, so you go ahead and engage in conversation with Kelly.
Well, just flipping back and forth between the life jacket one and the previous one that I mistakenly said to her was Noah. They, you know, if you added a few years, it's definitely a possibility for sure. Like, there's noticeable features, the eyes, the difference in between the nose and everything. It looks pretty reasonable to guess that could be an age difference.
And if you did you notice the slope of the eye again? See that left eye on the Michael Vabner? How it slopes down just like on Noah's photos. I've been pointing out throughout this whole slideshow, keep looking at that left eye, and I've been pointing out how that slopes down in the bow in his mouth and his upper lip, and how his lips turn up on the corners, and then their color of their eyes are identical.
It almost looks to me, if you look at the one called Michael, the lip shape almost looks like a mustache painted in red lipstick, almost like it's more featured as that, and then when you flip to the life jacket boy, it's the distinguishable really red lips on Noah. But it looks really close to the same just from that. You know what I mean? If you aged, you would have filled out, and they wouldn't be as full as this, but.
And what do you think of the eyebrows? I mean, Noah has bushy eyebrows for a little tiny boy, and so does this guy.
Well, if it is two different people, they both need a trim.
I'm not saying it is the same person. I'm saying it could be.
It's possible.
It's possible. And it's just another avenue to question.
Well, you know? If a lot of people are accurate, like I've seen a lot of other people claiming on the internet that there's a possibility this is like a whole generational, the pictures are from the past. They're poising them off now, so you're obviously not going to find a bunch of 6-year-old and 7-year-olds because these people are all 17, 18 now. So, you know, this could be what you've stumbled upon.
Because if nobody died at Sandy Hook, and we know that nobody did because we know the school was closed. So if we know the school was closed, there couldn't have been a shooting. Therefore, Noah could not be dead. So where's Noah? Is he somewhere, or is he right here in these pictures? You know, is he right underneath our noses? But they thought, well, we'll never recognize these people because they're in their 20s today. if Chance, if you'll go to that one picture of just the eye.
And Kelly, if we use this as an illustration, as a sample, it suggests all the other photographs may also bear a similar relationship between the young people today and the photographs that are being shown, which are 10 or 15 years younger than they are today.
Well, one researcher thinks that she's found Grace McDonald, and she's 21.
So that would be, again, 15 years difference.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, Chance, if you could go to that one picture. Yeah, just the eyes. Now, I found this. Do those look blue to you? Okay, well, to me, those look like green eyes to me, and I'm just not seeing any blue, and this was taken from the grandmother's website. She even says they were the color of the river.
Now, Kelly, did you get that picture that's front on of the older boy where his eyes are really straight looking right into the camera?
Yes, Chance just showed that.
That's the one Chance just showed? Okay, good.
And
I thought that was among the most important of all the photographs you have, and I was rather upset that they aren't showing based upon what I sent you.
So, Chance, I think you just need to make that as big as you can, and the one with him in the life jacket, because those two pictures right there, I just see so many similarities. And I've shown this to just complete strangers. I didn't even tell them what I was doing. I just went up to some strangers, and I said, can I show you some photos? And they said yes, and I said, okay. Would you say that this is the same person all grown up? And two complete strangers looked at that and said, yeah, that's the same person. So I just found this over the weekend.
That's really good, Kelly. So, that's really good.
So this is the first time anybody's seen these photos side by side.
Let me just emphasize, Kelly, that the most important aspect of scientific research is fashioning the hypothesis. Once you have an hypothesis, it's usually fairly obvious how to test it. And I think you've done a fantastic job of fashioning the hypothesis that this alleged half brother is actually Noah grown up.
Yes.
Could Noah actually be the younger version of the half brother who's been given the novel name Noah Posner?
Right. And it's, I don't know. It, to me, it just looks a lot like him, like it could be him. And the only thing that has me stumped is the hair. You know, somehow he got curly hair between. He had it naturally curly. That's why I showed you at the very beginning that he had naturally curly hair. And then somehow it got straight, and now it's curly again. And Danielle's was straight when she was little, and now it's curly. So, you know, maybe it's not the same people if you go just by the hair. Maybe they've had perms to try to keep them to where people would notice.
Yeah, but Kelly, the points you've been making about the mouth and the eye and so forth and the color, those seem to me to be variables that are very difficult to change if they're changeable at all. Whereas the appearance of the hair would be relatively easy to modify. So I think the traits that you've been featuring seem to be more telling than the hair, even if there's variation.
Right. And also, you know, Jim, and I'm not saying that this is him, you know, for sure. I'm just saying, like you said, it's a line of questioning. And I see the mouth and the eyes and the eyebrows and the nose and the ears and the hair color. It's all, you know, it looks like the same.
Yeah, I think you're really onto something, Kelly. And the fact is, we know that Lenny Posner is a fraud. We know that Lenny Posner is a liar. We know that Lenny Posner is performing a service by attacking Sandy Hook researchers. We know these articles he's published in the Hartford Courant and the Sun Sentinel and elsewhere are a disgrace. They are total fabrications. They don't have a word of truth in them. And it's utterly irresponsible that so many in the major media have simply swooned before this story, this hoax whose artificiality has been demonstrated dozens and dozens and dozens of different ways in the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, and in the presentations that have been made on this program. And I think your suggestion that this alleged half-brother may actually be the person we know as Noah Posner grown up raises several different alternatives, that there really was a little Noah Posner who grew up to be identified as the half-brother, or that the half-brother, when he was much younger, was very photogenic, and that they have simply used those photographs and assigned to him the name Noah Posner to make it all look like it's a coherent story.
Right, exactly. And it's I found a photograph of Veronique's first husband, and he looks looks like Lenny Posner, actually. It was kind of very strange, but anyway.
Well, that's very interesting. Could it be that that her first husband was Lenny Posner?
You've got me. And don't forget, we've got the twin, Ariel. And is that Danielle today? You know, it could be Danielle, could be Ariel.
Well, listen, Kelly, I'm so grateful to you for sharing your research. However tentative and infallible it may be, in the sense that with more research, we may revise some of the conjectures you're offering here, and that it's always possible you could be wrong. I think you've made enough of a case to be inclined to believe that there's something to what you're proposing here. It wouldn't surprise me at all if this is the same person, much older, and that was the way they organized the scam. They took pictures of children much younger, because many commentators, including the author of the top 10 reasons Sandy Hook is a an elaborate hoax in the book, was reflecting, Vivian Lee was reflecting on how, and Sophia Smallstorm has before her, on how the children in these photographs seem to be wearing clothing that's much, much outdated. And if it were indeed the case that these children are all 15 years or more older than they were when those photographs were taken, that would certainly explain the anomalies related to the clothing. And other observations you've made would explain the anomalies in the short sleeve shirts and the shorts and all that, and what appears to be unusually good weather season round, which would be more characteristic of Florida than it would of Connecticut.
Right. And that's what kind of got me started in the first place. I wanted to see if Ariel, the twin, was wearing UGG boots. And I set out trying to find some winter photos, and I never could find the winter photos until I found two last night, just those two.
Kelly, I can't thank you enough. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest this first hour, Kelly Watt, for sharing her latest research with us. Stand by for the new JFK show with Gary King. We'll be right back.
Say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the Silent Historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful, I'm just a patsy. And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Welcome to the new JFK show number 88. We've got Dr. Fetzer. We're going to have Larry Rivera and Don Fox, myself, and Chance George in the engineer's chair tonight. All right, we're going to be taking a bold step forward. This video that I made this morning is a response to Alex Jones, Robert Groden, and Jim Mars answering a question from a caller concerning Israeli involvement in the JFK assassination. Now, we've had Jim Eugenio say that he's read Michael Collins Piper's book. However, he finds it unconvincing. So we're going to just let everyone, you know, find out for themselves. And I'd like to think that we have Michael Collins Piper on tonight as our guest. Even though he passed away last year, I think his legacy carries on. So we're going to watch a video, and then we'll have our JFK team comment on it as soon as we're done.
Bye.
But he, along with Robert Groden, went on to say that there was no evidence of Israeli involvement. Now, what was interesting is that Jim Mars also went on to say that Israel did not have the power over here in the United States to subvert the CIA and the FBI and the military, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, other power groups involved in the assassination. Well, Jim Mars is obviously not reading his history correctly, because he will find very quickly, as far as the CIA was concerned, that the number three man in the CIA, James Angleton, who was head of the Mossad desk and was a Mossad loyalist, he was not Jewish. He was not Jewish, ladies and gentlemen. He was a Mossad loyalist and very close to the Mossad. He has been implicated time and time again in the very specific circumstances designed to frame Lee Harvey Oswald for involvement in the JFK assassination. The fact is, as I say, James Angleton has been linked repeatedly to key elements of the JFK assassination conspiracy and cover-up. Likewise, I would mention David Atlee Phillips. David Atlee Phillips has been a popular figure there. He was the guy who ran the Mexico City station for the CIA. I can tell you this much, ladies and gentlemen. After he left the CIA, he went to work for an arms smuggling company that was connected to the Israelis, and they were actually smuggling arms to Iran. So you do find David Atlee Phillips involved there, someone with Israeli connections. Now, I'm going to talk more about some more CIA connections to the Mossad a little bit further, but let's talk about the FBI. Now, there's no question that the FBI played a major part in the JFK assassination cover-up. Who headed the FBI at that time? J. Edgar Hoover. Ladies and gentlemen, J. Edgar Hoover's ties to the Anti-Defamation League, which is today a lobby for Israel, his ties working closely with the Anti-Defamation League go back to the 1930s and 1940s when the Anti-Defamation League played a pivotal role, as I just mentioned here in this show the other night, in supplying information to the FBI and the Justice Department in bringing sedition charges against American citizens who were critics of the Roosevelt administration. In addition, it is known that, for example, JFK assassination researcher Dick Gregory, the famous black comic, social critic, he got his own FBI files and found very specifically that at times when he was being monitored in discussing the JFK assassination, and this material ended up in the JFK assassination, or in the FBI files, that the actual monitoring of Dick Gregory was being done by the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith and then being passed on to the CIA. I might as well get into it a little bit further here. We all know about former FBI and CIA, former FBI agent and CIA contract operative Guy Bannister, who operated out of New Orleans. The guy who Lee Harvey Oswald apparently was doing some fact finding for. Well, the fact is, ladies and gentlemen, that Guy Bannister was very, very close to the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, specifically the head of the ADL's office in New Orleans, headed by B. Botnick, who called himself a super communist hunter, who was determined to infiltrate as many left-wing organizations as possible. And he and Guy Bannister worked very, very closely in New Orleans. So that's a fact, ladies and gentlemen. So there you find both the FBI and the CIA and the intrigue surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans. Many, many people have implicated Frank Sturgis, including myself, in the circumstances surrounding the JFK assassination. Frank Sturgis, ladies and gentlemen, worked for the Mossad going back to 1948 and up through the 50s. We all know about FBI agent Hostie, some pronounce it Hostie, in Dallas, who was responsible for monitoring Lee Harvey Oswald. Mr. Hostie's primary responsibility was monitoring right-wing extremists. Well, if he was monitoring right-wing extremists down there in Dallas, ladies and gentlemen, that means that Mr. Hostie was working closely with the Anti-Defamation League, which made it its responsibility to work closely with the FBI. Yeah, what about Mr. Hostie down there in Dallas? And then, of course, what about the Warren Commission, ladies and gentlemen, the one that ultimately arranged the cover-up of the Kennedy assassination? Of the 14 assistant counsel, 5 were Jewish. Another was married to a Jewish woman. Of the 7 other staff members, lawyers and law clerks, 4 were Jewish. That means that the 22 lawyers in question, nearly half of them, including the staffer whose wife was Jewish, could be described as constituting a Jewish presence on the commission. Now, let's look at some of these people who were on the Warren Commission. The one of great interest, Albert Jenner Jr. of Chicago. At the time Jenner was named to the commission, he served as the personal attorney to Chicago's construction and real estate tycoon, Henry Crown. Now, by the way, the Crown family had been very close to Barack Obama. A Jewish billionaire, Crown was a major contributor to Jewish causes, including the Weizmann Institute in Israel, a major force in Israel's nuclear weapons program that JFK so strenuously opposed. Crown also is a major stockholder in the General Dynamics Corporation, which General also represented, which was under investigation by the Kennedy Justice Department. Other major stockholders in General Dynamics were the Bronfman family. The Bronfman family were the powers behind the Permandex Corporation, on whose board of directors sat Clay Shaw of New Orleans. And, of course, Clay Shaw of New Orleans was featured very prominently in Oliver Stone's film JFK. Let's check out another person who was on the Warren Commission, Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford, the man behind Gerald Ford, in fact, he was once described as one of the mystery men behind Gerald Ford who would tell the president what to do and when to do it. Max Fisher was in turn tied very closely to the elements around the Permandex Corporation. Max Fisher was a leading supporter of Israel here in the United States. He was also tied very closely to the Cleveland Crime Syndicate, which, of course, was part of the Meyer-Lansky Crime Syndicate. Folks, it goes on and on and on. What about, you know, what about Jack Ruby, ladies and gentlemen? Jack Ruby bragged that he was smuggling arms to Israel. But in more recent years, okay, Jack Ruby, how much more lower in the level can you get? Dr. William Pepper, who has represented James Earl Ray and has written about the assassination of Martin Luther King, Dr. William Pepper has pointed out that back in 1963, Jack Ruby was personally involved in an arms smuggling operation, which was stealing arms from U.S. armories. And one of the people involved in this arms smuggling operation was a high-ranking Mossad officer. He doesn't name him, but I have reason to believe it was Michael Harari. Jack Ruby had a definitive Mossad tie, and this relationship with this Mossad officer also involved Raoul, the famous person whom James Earl Ray contended several years later was his handler in the Martin Luther King assassination. You see, folks, there are a lot of Mossad connections and connections through the Lansky Crime Syndicate and connections through the Permandex Corporation, which is another matter altogether. Now, why is it then that they're saying there are none of these Mossad connections, very definitive Mossad connections? I was shocked of the 180-degree turnabout in U.S. foreign policy that took place upon JFK's assassination. Yeah, you know, this whole aspect of JFK and nuclear weapons in Israel, you know, we have this guy Clay Shaw serving on the board of Permandex, chief executive officer of Permandex, is Louis Bloomfield, who, along with the Bronfman family, was among a group of American and Canadian millionaires who put up about $150 million for Israel's nuclear arms programs. Who funded Clay Shaw's defense when Jim Garrison of New Orleans prosecuted Clay Shaw? It was the Stern family of New Orleans, a very powerful Jewish family in New Orleans who owned WDSU radio and television station that played a major part in painting Lee Harvey Oswald as a pro-communist extremist. And guess what? The Stern family were also major shareholders in the NUMEC nuclear plant up in Pennsylvania, from which it appears that nuclear materiel was smuggled from the United States to Israel with the connivance, ladies and gentlemen, of James Angleton, the number three man in the CIA. Pretty tight connections to the Bronfman Syndicate, the Lansky Syndicate, Israel's Mossad. Ladies and gentlemen, why is Alex Jones ignoring this? Why is Alex Jones covering this up? And what about Frank Sturgis' ties to the Mossad going back to 1948? Then when you start looking at the circles surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald, everyone from Clay Shaw to apparently Frank Sturgis and Guy Bannister, who were all interconnected, to Annie Castro Cuban training camps down around New Orleans. Who were funding some of those camps down there in New Orleans, ladies and gentlemen? People from the Jewish Crime Syndicate. These were elements that were apparently entirely separate from some of the other CIA-funded operations against Castro. Very specific, funny little groups that were operating down there, ladies and gentlemen. And the guy who introduced Lee Harvey Oswald to David Ferry, Mr. O'Sullivan, knew Oswald from homeroom in high school. Mr. O'Sullivan later became chief of detectives or chief of police intelligence in New Orleans during the Jim Garrison investigation. And then after that, guess what he did? He gave up. Fred O'Sullivan, he gave up his American citizenship. He converted to Judaism and went to Israel, where he became Ephraim O'Sullivan and went to work for Israel's Mossad. And today his son, Ari O'Sullivan, is a military correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. What about Lyndon Johnson? Look, I don't doubt that Lyndon Johnson probably knew about it, or once he knew about it, what really happened, he knew what to do and why he should do it because of the Jewish power groups in this country. And in Final Judgment, we document very carefully and thoroughly that Lyndon Johnson was one of the key Israeli handmaidens in the United States Senate. But I'm here to tell you, Lyndon Johnson was not the mastermind of the JFK assassination. And I'm here to tell you also that there is evidence pointing to Israeli involvement at all sorts of levels here, ladies and gentlemen, high and low, and you cannot get away from it. There's no one who's ever, ever taken away from the integrity or criticized the judgment of the late Penn Jones. Penn Jones said, Jack Ruby was a close intimate of the members of the Dallas Police Force and other U.S. law enforcement agencies, as well as the Israeli counterintelligence organization, along with his one-time employee, Nancy Perrin-Rich. Identifying Ruby as being involved with the Israeli intelligence opens up a completely overlooked area concerning the assassination of President Kennedy. Penn Jones of Texas later wrote, Jack Ruby was admittedly used by the FBI in small-time information gathering, but he appears to have been a bigger operative for some other agency or country. And I'll mention also that going back to Jack Ruby's days when he was called to testify before congressional committees and looking into organized crime, his attorney was Louis Kuttner. Louis Kuttner had long-standing ties to Israeli intelligence. Jack Ruby's attorney, the guy that represented him before the U.S. government.
After all, we are talking about the murder of an American president. We're talking about a coup d'etat that resulted in a 180-degree turnabout in U.S. policy towards Israel and the Arab world, a policy that resulted in Israel being able to build nuclear weapons, which JFK opposed. And it's because of Israel having nuclear weapons, which was a consequence of John F. Kennedy's assassination, that we are in the position where we are today, bogged down in Iraq. After all, we fought the Iraq war to prevent Iraq from building nuclear weapons, so we were told. But, folks, what seems to be forgotten is the primary reason why Iraq was building nuclear weapons, and that, of course, is because they had some concerns about, and that's putting it lightly, about the fact that Israel was already sitting on a gigantic nuclear arsenal in the Middle East. That's what the Iraq war was all about, ladies and gentlemen. And that's what the impending Iran war is all about, ladies and gentlemen. So Israel's nuclear weapons are an important issue, and particularly in the context of the JFK assassination. My point has been from the very beginning that you cannot take a complete look at the JFK assassination and the cover-up that followed without addressing the fact that there is as solid a basis for the theory of Israeli involvement as there is for a theory of CIA involvement or organized crime involvement. Yes, Israel did have the power through its agents and friends of agents of influence and friends here in the United States, such as J. Edgar Hoover, such as James Angleton, the number three man, the director of counterintelligence in the CIA, ladies and gentlemen. We talked about Frank Sturgis, who has been often linked to the Kennedy assassination and who he did, in fact, admit in writing. Sturgis specifically said in the letter that he was working for James Angleton of the CIA. And, of course, Angleton was not only the number three man in the CIA, but the very pro-Israel head of the Mossad desk there. Sturgis was a Haganah mercenary during the first 1988 Israeli-Arab war. He also had a girlfriend in Europe who worked for Israeli intelligence and with whom he worked. He worked as a courier in Europe, and it was well known among anti-Castro and Cuban exiles that Sturgis had worked for the Mossad and done so for a long, long time, folks. Sturgis worked for the Mossad going up into the 1970s. Also, what you also have to keep in mind is that Mexico City, which played a very major role in the circumstances surrounding the CIA office in Mexico City, surrounding the JFK assassination, Mexico City was also a hub of Mossad operations. In fact, there were also 12 to 16 Mossad agents that worked out of Miami. And their influence reached throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. Now, what's interesting is that if you'll recall, there's a lot of evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald was mixed up with anti-Castro groups in the New Orleans area.
Now, Professor John Newman of the University of Maryland has pointed out that Frank Sturgis founded the International Anti-Communist Brigade and that the backers of Sturgis's group have never been fully established. Now, a unit of Sturgis's brigade was something called Interpen that operated outside New Orleans. It was run by Jerry Patrick Hemming, and Sturgis was connected with Hemming and Interpen. Now, those activities of Jerry Hemming's group, Interpen, were known to have involved Guy Bannister and David Ferry, and of course, many of you are familiar with those names. According to Jerry Hemming himself, Interpen's most important contact in the United States was Theodore Rakusin, a New York financier, whom Hemming himself described as one of the key founders of the State of Israel. So not only did we find Clay Shaw of New Orleans, memorialized in that famous film JFK, to which Jim Mars contributed and received a big chunk of money from the Israeli arms dealer who was financing the film, which was produced by Oliver Stone, directed by Oliver Stone. We not only find Clay Shaw of New Orleans tied to the Mossad through his association with the infamous Permandex company, we also find two other CIA-connected players in the anti-Castro operations out of New Orleans, Frank Sturgis and Jerry Hemming, involved in the Mossad sphere of influence, and Lee Harvey Oswald has been tied to all these key players. So, folks, right there on an operational level in New Orleans, two different strands, one with Clay Shaw and one with Frank Sturgis and Jerry Patrick Hemming, tied directly to Lee Harvey Oswald at the lowest operational level of the Kennedy assassination conspiracy. And we do know for a fact, as I say, that Jack Ruby had his own connections to the Mossad. This was documented by Dr. William Pepper. In fact, don't forget, when Jack Ruby was in the Dallas police station, he told people he was working as a translator for Israeli newspapers. All these JFK researchers, they've never determined who those Israeli newspapers were, and it's a known fact, ladies and gentlemen, that the Mossad, over the years, has, and this has been documented, the Mossad, not by Mike Piper, by others, the Mossad has utilized Israeli newspaper reporters as their assets. In his book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, Jim Mars references the JFK assassination, I think in an entire chapter, and he admits in that chapter that Colonel Louis Bloomfield, who was the chief executive officer and chairman of the board of this mysterious company named Permandex, he admits, I believe, as Jim Mars puts it, that Louis Bloomfield had quote-unquote Zionist connections. But then he goes on to suggest that this Permandex operation and the entirety of the JFK conspiracy was a Nazi plot. Now, Louis Bloomfield was a top lawyer and henchman of the Bronfman family. He was a major player in Israel's fundraiser for Israel's nuclear weapons program. Now, when you put these things together in the context of the connection to Clay Shaw, who was on the board of Permandex and whose defense in the Garrison trial was funded by the Stern family of New Orleans, a prominent Jewish family who also were investors in the NUMEC corporation from which nuclear materiel was smuggled to Israel. And then you take all these connections from Lee Harvey Oswald to Guy Bannister and David Ferry to this group in New Orleans that was an anti-Castro group that was being funded by a person who was one of the quote-unquote founders of Israel. You can't get away from it. Data about the very distinct fine hand of the Israeli connection in the events in Dallas, Texas, in Dallas, in the months preceding the JFK assassination. Although I was busy researching Final Judgment, looking for Israeli connections, I missed it right on the ground in Dallas, the city where they actually pulled off the crime. When I say they, I don't mean all Israel, but I will temper those comments with the fact that In Final Judgment, my very controversial book on the JFK assassination, which, of course, first came out in 1994, January of 1994, I had a whole chapter, which I still have in the book, entitled A Bad Habit, one of the early chapters, A Bad Habit, Israel's Use of False Flags in Global Terrorism, Pointing the Finger of Guilt Elsewhere. Over the years, the Israelis have utilized this tactic very cleverly, and of course I do believe that to a large extent this is exactly what happened in Dallas. That's why the crime is often blamed on the quote-unquote anti-Castro Cubans, or maybe sometimes even on Fidel Castro himself. All right, well, here goes, folks. Just the facts. This thing was entitled The Kennedy Assassination and Israel, Some Dallas Connection. But if you understand the real Dallas, not the city of legend and of Hollywood drama, it prepares you for what I had already written about in Final Judgment, and now tied it all together in a way that just absolutely amazed me. The document buried the tired old myth that a clique of anti-Semitic, white Anglo-Saxon, Protestant oil plutocrats ruled Dallas. Instead, the truth was quite the opposite. Not only did Dallas have an immensely powerful Jewish community, but more importantly, the city and Texas itself had been a major center of fundraising and arms smuggling on behalf of the Zionist cause going back to the 1940s. Even Jonathan Pollard, the American spy for Israel, said he was inspired to pro-Israel activism by stories he heard while living in Texas of gun running for the Israeli underground by Jews in Texas. In fact, now, ladies and gentlemen, all these details I'm giving you were not things that I dug out. They were dug out by this professional writer, whom I suspect, frankly, was Jim Mars, who then sent this to me anonymously. In fact, the official published history of a major Zionist arms smuggling operation, known as the Sonneborn Institute, reported that its agents smuggled aircraft parts out of Texas to Israel. Now, this is interesting. They were smuggling aircraft parts out of Texas to Israel just at the time when a recently discharged Army Air Corps aircraft mechanic, Jack Ruby, was resettling in Dallas in 1947. That's when Sonneborn's activities were at a zenith. Now, Ruby later bragged of having run arms to Israel, according to FBI documents that were brought out by researcher, Jewish American researcher A.J. Weberman. And according to Dr. William Pepper, as we now know, Ruby was known to have been part of an Israeli arms smuggling operation in the Southwest overseen by an Israeli intelligence officer. So the Israeli connection to Texas was a lot more intimate than many today ever realized. Now, in 1963, JFK's primary interest in Dallas was raising money from the Dallas elite. And that meant, folks, the wealthy pro-Israel Jewish Democrats who were major financial angels for the ruling Democratic Party there. Now, of course, since JFK was at that time at loggerheads with Israel over its nuclear program, it's critical to recognize how JFK was lured to Dallas and who was in charge of the arrangements that actually facilitated, in the end, his assassination. Now, it's known, well known among JFK researchers that the Dallas leg of JFK's Texas trip was sponsored by the Citizens Council. That's an elite business group that ruled Dallas. Now, in most JFK literature, we're led to, a lot of people get it confused and they think that Citizens Council was the same as the White Citizens Council. And they say there were all these, you know, Texas oil money and this and that, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant anti-Semite racist. No. The elite business group that ruled Dallas, the Citizens Council, fact is, two of the three key figures who dominated the Citizens Council were Jewish. These were the folks who really ran Dallas, not conservatives as affiliated with the John Birch Society, as the old legend suggests. In 1963, one of those Jewish power brokers was an outspokenly pro-Israel liquor wholesaler, Julius Schweppes, who held the distribution rights in Dallas for the Bronfman family's Seagram's products. Now, as I've written further in Final Judgment, There's evidence that Jack Ruby was actually himself on the payroll of the Bronfman family, and their fingerprints are found all over the JFK assassination conspiracy. So here we have one of the rulers of Dallas, Julius Schweppes, part of this Citizens Council that was in charge of the arrangements for JFK in Dallas, setting the parade route, setting the location of where JFK spoke. Powerful family connected right to the Bronfmans, who in turn were connected to Clay Shaw in New Orleans. It goes on and on and on. But there's a lot more details here, folks, and we're gonna go into them. Stay tuned. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here at republicbroadcasting.org. Talking about the truth about Dallas, the myth of Dallas. Okay. Before the break, talked about two of the three key figures in the Citizens Council, the big elite business group that ruled Dallas. Two of them were Jewish Americans. No, they weren't white Anglo-Saxon Protestant members of the Ku Klux Klan and members of the John Birch Society. Now, this group actually gained control of the Dallas leg of JFK's Texas trip. This is interesting. Since JFK's Dallas trip was officially designated as non-political, in contrast to other stops in Texas, such as those in Houston and Austin, which were designated political, the private entities paying for the Dallas trip gained control of the planning, and that took it out of the hands of the Democratic National Committee, which was controlled by John F. Kennedy. Well, the Citizens Council designated a host committee, and the chairman of that host committee was Sam Bloom, who was a longtime executive director of the Citizens Council and also a very highly regarded Jewish leader in Dallas. Now, I don't have the original notes with me in front of me, but unless I'm mistaken, he used to be the president of the same synagogue that Jack Ruby attended. In any case, what's interesting is there was an immediate confrontation between Mr. Bloom, representing the Dallas elite, and Jerry Bruno, who was JFK's veteran advance man. Bruno wanted the president to speak at the women's building, but the rulers of Dallas insisted that JFK speak at the trade march. Now, although Bruno fought long and hard after much pressure, the Dallas elite prevailed, and this caused Bruno, this JFK loyalist, to comment, quote, "This was one of the few fights like this that I had that I lost. On things like this, my judgment was usually taken. This time, it wasn't." Now, by forcing JFK to speak at the trademark, which is really what they did, folks, the Dallas elite positioned the JFK motorcade to take the now infamous dogleg turn into what was the classically sniper-friendly kill zone on Elm Street, just below the Texas School Book Depository, from where they claim Lee Harvey Oswald fired the fatal shots. The spot was also in easy range of the grassy knoll and the nearby Dow Tech building, where people believe snipers were also located. Now, you see, had JFK's advance man, Jerry Bruno, prevailed, as he usually did, JFK, on his way to the preferred location, the women's building, would have traveled two blocks further away from the school book depository, out of the kill zone proper, at a greater speed, probably much greater speed. Now, although the Secret Service objected for security reasons to the publication of JFK's motorcade route, Bloom, the point man for the Dallas elite, nonetheless made sure a map of the route was repeatedly published in Dallas papers. Thus, later, when Lee Harvey Oswald, the patsy, was in custody, there was a plausible explanation as to how he knew JFK would pass by his workplace. Now, talking about the Dow Tech building as a possible location there in Dealey Plaza of another assassin, this is very, very relevant in the context of an Israeli connection. The Dow Tech building was co-owned by David Weisblatt, who was a major financial backer of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. The Dow Tech building housed on different floors a number of firms that utilized the telephone number of Morty Friedman, an attorney, garment manufacturer, and activist in Jewish affairs. Now, one Daltex firm linked to Friedman was the Dallas Uranium and Oil Company. And that's interesting, of course, because JFK was working to stop Israel's nuclear arms program, which received smuggled uranium from U.S. sources. But listen to this. One of Friedman's Daltex business partners in another company was Abraham Zapruder, the Jewish dress manufacturer who filmed the assassination. And as you probably know, there are some people who believe that Zapruder may have had advanced knowledge of the assassination. I don't go so far as to say that, but when you look at all these details together, it's kind of interesting. Now, once Lee Harvey Oswald was in custody, it was the same Sam Bloom who had earlier maneuvered JFK into the kill zone who pressured Elgin Krall, the Dallas city manager, to in turn pressure Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry into making Oswald accessible to the press and to move Oswald publicly from the Dallas police station to the city jail. I'm going to repeat that. It was Sam Bloom who set JFK to speak at the Trade Mart and thus go through Dealey Plaza, who also pressured the city manager to in turn pressure the Dallas police chief into making Oswald accessible to the press and to move him publicly from the Dallas police station to the city jail. So the situation was in place for Jack Ruby to move in for the kill. There are several sources, including Dallas FBI agent James Hostey, who stated Bloom and his backers were the forces behind this. And you know what? When the police searched Jack Ruby's home, they found a slip of paper with Bloom's name, address, and telephone number on it.
All right. I'm glad to have my panel here. I'll quote Don. It seems like an avalanche of one thing after another. And as Michael Collins Piper screamed out several times, you just can't get away from it. I went ahead and did an F5 on Black Up Radio today, which is a search. I typed in Israel. Still zero. And it appears to me that this was done in the mid-90s before Black Op Radio came around, and not one hint of Michael Collins Piper. Right or wrong, I don't understand why he shouldn't be on there. So,
I got to tell you, Gary, listening to this, it seems to me one of the best presentations Michael Collins Piper ever gave. It impressed me very much right across the board. So it enhanced my opinion of him.
Well, what happened is a caller called in and confronted Alex Jones, and this is around 2008 or 9 or something like that.
Yep, it was November 2008.
Mm-hmm. And from what I'm starting to admire, people who were criticizing Alex Jones in the 90s, but he was a little leery because Alex Jones was so big, but he had Jim Mars on the show and he had Robert Grodin, and they were point blank asked if Israel had anything to do with it. Now, Robert Grodin jumped right away and said, absolutely nothing, absolutely nothing. And Jim Mars was a little more, sidestepping a little bit. And he said that, well, maybe at the highest levels, we may have to have, you know, they would have to at least acquiesce on allowing the assassination to happen. Any comment, fellas?
Yeah, I was going to jump in quick. The last thing Piper uttered there was about Sam Bloom. And then when they were going through Ruby's apartment, they found a slip of paper on it with Sam Bloom's name, phone number, and address on there in Ruby's apartment after he'd gotten arrested for shooting Oswald.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Jim? Go ahead, Don.
Okay, as we all know, Sam Bloom was intimately connected with the whole transfer, you know, as Piper was talking about, the transfer of Oswald from the Dallas police station to the city jail. Bloom was putting pressure on the city manager, who was in turn putting pressure on the police chief, to make the transfer public. How many JFK researchers ever talk about that?
Yeah, that's a great point, Don. It's a great point. Setting it up to shoot Oswald by making the information public and giving everyone an understanding that it was going to happen I mean, that's very clear. They had to take him out. They had to silence Lee before what he had to say would become known.
And the point man said he's never, ever been denied his wishes in setting up a route for the president to go down. He said, but this time it was different, and they pressured me hard, and you see what happened. And it was Sam Bloom. How often do you hear Sam Bloom? The whole JFK thing.
Yeah, I've heard plenty of people deny Israeli involvement, and other people screech, there's no evidence for that. But they never talk about Sam Bloom. They never do. They don't talk about.
These are people who only listen to Black Op Radio, Don.
Yeah, or people that are on Black Op Radio. Like, that was kind of a bad Joan Mellon impression there. That.
All right, Larry, what you think of all this?
Well, what strikes me the most of this short and sweet presentation, this video, is how this cast of characters that we have been bringing up so many times here in previous shows keeps rearing their ugly heads here. For example, Permendex, you know, and Bloom, and the expanded role that is revealed here of Jack Ruby, which some of these... some of these revelations, you know, might surprise some people, but they come as no surprise. Perhaps this is the reason why, one of the reasons why Ruby insisted on Warren to take him to Washington if he really wanted to get a fair shake out of him, you know. So it's quite revealing. Sometimes, you know, this information requires, you know, rehashing and to be brought out again over and over for people to understand what's really going on here.
Seems like everyone was working for the ADL, just gathering information for the Anti-Defamation League from way back. Hoover was doing it in the 30s.
Another thing which really struck me was the study of the composition of the different counsels and lawyers who made up the Warren Commission, for example, Albert Jenner and et cetera, you know, and the Jewish composition of, you know, so many of these key investigators who carried a lot of the weight here as far as the actual investigation of the Warren Commission. You know, these assistant counsels were the ones that did the road work. And they're the ones that did most of the investigating, and whatever they decided to present and to bring out was what was carried throughout the Warren Commission. For example, Joseph Ball, you know, who is a very key individual in this whole Warren Commission investigation, where he was key in for example, the doorway, you know, which the people that were in the doorway and what kind of information was presented to the Warren Commission as far as which the most important part of who was the man in the doorway. And so that just an example of what some of the key aspects of these assistant counsels and most of them, a lot of them were, you know, Jewish. So that's just an observation of mine.
And I guess we'll be forever indebted to Arlen Specter for the magic bullet theory.
Yeah, among others, yeah.
Yeah, another Jewish lawyer on the Warren Commission, the ambitious junior counselor. You know, and before we maybe get off on too far of a tangent, one of the, I don't know if it was in the, this half hour presentation, but Gary edited this down from a 3+ hour YouTube clip. And, Piper was talking about Robert Grodin, because that was, you know, that was what originally had set Piper off, was Jim Mars and Robert Grodin on the Alex Jones show back in, I think it was November 10th of 2008. And he talked about Bob Grodin. I mean, you can hear Bob Grodin flatly denying Israeli involvement in that show. And then Piper was talking about the fact that he thinks Grodin is Jewish.
He said that? I didn't catch that.
Yeah, he did say that. Yeah, I'll find that. We can play that little clip next week.
And what do you think about Jim Mars being the one that anonymously sent the 19 points of Israeli involvement? He really believes it. It was Jim Mars. So I talked to Jim Mars in New Orleans, And every time I mention Israel, he agreed, but he won't get up behind the microphone and do it. So I guess you're living in Dallas, Texas. It's really not the place to get too cocky, huh?
Dallas, Texas is a well-known Zionist stronghold. I mean, it's no coincidence that Alex Jones sprung up not too far from there. And, I think Jim Mars knows where it's at. He started out life as just a city reporter, I think, for just one of those local papers there in Dallas. And it would make perfect sense because what Piper had said earlier was that he got a data dump from an anonymous local, Dallas reporter. And it would make a lot of sense that if it was Jim Mars, I mean, think about it. What local beat reporter of that era has done more work on JFK than Jim Mars?
Right. It's a short list of people who would have that much in-depth knowledge just to send a paper out.
Yeah. And, you know, Jim Mars to me was one of my early heroes in JFK research. I mean, I got that book Crossfire. I saw the movie JFK, and then I went to the library and I checked out Fletcher Prouty's JFK Vietnam, the CIA, and the Plot to Assassinate John F. Kennedy, which was a book that really, really changed my life. Reading that book, that taught me how the other side thinks, you know, how the intel op world, how they actually think and what they, you know, and then from there, I got Crossfire, by Jim Mars. I had checked out, David Lifton's Best Evidence, and I had no idea what occipital parietal meant until I started reading Best Evidence. And, that was another life changer to think about how they could alter, you know, the body like that. And I mean, when you think about how much was at stake, well, these guys were going to do whatever it took to get the job done. So, altering the body was certainly in play.
It's amazing. They seem confident, but they also seem, very paranoid that things may go wrong, and they're quick to take out witnesses. And, now Jim Mars was writing a book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. And, pretty much if you substitute the word Nazi for Zionist, then,
and let us not forget that, you know, a point Piper brought up was that Jim Mars did get a pretty fat paycheck from the guy that was behind financing the movie JFK, Milken.
Right, the former, no, the current Israeli arms dealer. How come everyone has to be an Israeli arms dealer or a smuggler or whatever it takes for the state of Israel? And then he did say the dramatic change in foreign policy. We've got the USS Liberty. The nuclear program has to be the most significant. And it was no nukes for Israel until he was 6 feet under. And it's been all Israel.
Well, of course, going whole hog into Vietnam, which JFK was pulling our forces out. You've got quite a few major issues involved here. I thought Michael was actually exemplary. I'm very impressed with this. And I think that Don did a search and found that on Black Op, they don't ever even mention Israel. I think that's rather disturbing all by itself.
Now,
for financing JFK, what better way to control the strings as to how much might be exposed related to possible Israeli complicity?
Jim, also, you have to throw in there one of LBJ's most influential and greatest supporters were Israel and the Israeli lobby, and Israel in general. So, you know, LBJ would have never gotten to where he got without their support.
Lyndon Johnson was Jewish. But both of his grandmothers were Jewish, so on the maternal side, so there's no question that he was Jewish.
And then come to find out, we have a recently discharged airline mechanic smuggling airplane parts to Israel. I mean, can we ship anything anywhere else? Is there any other location? Is there only one address stamp for everything?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, Jack Ruby was running airplane parts, guns, and all and LBJ was doing that too. He was in the 40s. LBJ was running guns into Palestine to help the, you know, the freedom fighters.
Oh, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Well, what you got to say about all this, Dr. Fetzer? It's a sort of new revelations from a 20-year-old.
I think it's all terrific, Gary. I think getting all this out to discuss, to, you know, angles to consider that have been largely overlooked in the past. I think that Michael Collins Piper may finally be getting some of the respect to which he's due for having been a pioneer in doing research on Israeli complicity in the assassination of JFK. I commend him.
Well, I kind of look at it like this. Larry's the one that told me. He says, you know, the things we're bringing up now, it may be 50 years from now before people are able to look at it in a fair way. But it appears to me that Michael Collins Piper was doing this in the mid-90s. And now here we are in 2016, and it's almost like new information. I've gotten so many comments and emails thanking us for bringing this information to it, and it's really not new.
Yeah, no, but it is new to the JFK research community. I mean, Piper had it out there, but let's face it, like, you know, like Jim DiEugenio, I think that clip we played a couple weeks ago on the show of him really summed it up. He's like, hey, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years and I haven't found any evidence for Israeli complicity, and neither have all the other people. Well, that's right. You weren't looking very hard, were you, Mr. DiEugenio?
No, and if they find it, they're going to turn their head quickly, that's for sure. Like I said, in 16 years, you can't even get one word to come up as far as any of this stuff is concerned. And it really is disheartening. I remember last week we were talking, they're in 2016, and they're ready to discuss the limo stop. Okay, that was just last week's show. And then putting down Michael Collins Piper's book is only two or three weeks ago. So they pretty much seem to be active in not allowing this in their gate. And so we're left to the only ones that are bringing this stuff up that I'm aware of in the JFK community, and that's for sure. And I've been to many a conference, and I'm still waiting. Other than Phil Nelson, he brings it up just a little bit, how Lyndon Johnson had one of his people in Hollywood and some sort of arrangement. They made certain that none of no bad movies or things would come out of Hollywood about Lyndon Johnson. It seemed to work to this very day.
Larry, would you like to add some thoughts about all this?
Well, no, I agree. We've been talking about this for, I think, weeks or months, Jim, and it's just something that requires a little more attention. Obviously, it's not going to come from the mainstream media.
We've actually had one of our shows banned, by the way.
Right. And I know. So, you know, it's the alternative media, you know, such as this platform is the only way that people are going to get a little more information about this.
Well, I'm a victim of, well, we all are, the Rouse and Kay. I had 2,800 views in one day. And now 2 months later, I've got 2,800 views. So we go to almost 3,000 views in a day. And it stopped. It just hadn't been 100 views in months now. So,
that's wrong. I mean, obviously, it's been getting viewed. They're just not, you know, the stats are skewed.
They're manipulating the count.
Yeah.
I hope it's at least getting out there. I'm okay with the count not being right if people are seeing it.
A friend of mine was keeping track of how many were searching for Nobody Died at Sandy Hook when I released it as a PDF. And he found millions were searching for it. But from day to day, the number would dramatically change, that they were suppressing it to a few hundred thousand, and then it would climb again, and then they'd readjust the figure.
Yeah. It's just amazing how we deal with all this. This may be a little off subject, but today I put on the news and we're having Mardi Gras in the city now. And they said that because of the Boston Marathon and the San Bernardino, that there will be more surveillance, more intelligence, more high technology. And they said it flat out. If you're in the city of New Orleans, you can rest assured that there's a camera on you at all times.
And you know, Gary, we even found the Craigslist ad for the extras at San Bernardino.
Yeah, it's just amazing how it's just fake news. And now we have more police. We have these contraptions. They're up in the air. They have right. these crank up. It's just everywhere.
Most of our viewers will be aware, but they could want to check out the Real Deal episode 137, Staging Attacks. From Sandy Hook to San Bernardino, if you don't know how these things are being done today, how flimsy is the fakery, check it out. You'll be a bit dumbfounded.
I agree with that, but I talk to people about this, and sometimes they get really upset. It appears to me that it's like the robot on Lost in Space. When you tell them this stuff, they're socially programmed that their wires are just crossed, and they just go hayriser, and it just doesn't compute. It doesn't compute. So we've got a long
Then you have a tearful president go before the nation, you know, pleading
fake,
to get guns
fake
off.
Fake tears from a fake president over a fake event. How can we top that, Larry?
On St. Charles Avenue are not fake with all their stuff. I mean, they're loaded to the gills with all kind of stuff to take you out.
And don't forget about the fake long-form birth certificate as well.
Oh, yeah, ridiculous.
We're living in a matrix. It's a big fake world out there, and if you want to prosper, you got to live with it. And if we say there was a massacre, then you go along with that. One word against it, and you're out.
What we're encountering is that fighting fascism is very difficult in a fascist state.
That's right.
We try to do it. So, all right, any closing comments, Larry?
No, I'm good. I'm good. It's glad to see everybody back on the job.
Yeah, man. We're still under attack. I mean, Chance lost his entire channel and 4,000 subscribers. My God. And 400 now. That's a hard hit. You know, but we'll just get up and dust ourselves off. Don, any closing comments?
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, to all these people out there that are denying the Israel angle, okay, then you have to explain Clay Shaw, Perm Index, Sam Bloom, Julius Schweppes, Edgar Bronfman, Louis Bloomfield, and on and on and on.
And don't overlook Jack Ruby.
No, Jack Rubenstein as well, yes.
That's right. And I think I would just close by saying, compliments to Michael Collins Piper. He was there before the rest of us. He seemed to have put his finger on a key aspect of the assassination, and he's entitled to respect for his accomplishment.
And let's don't forget Ed Tatro. Don't look at the trade mod. So we're looking at the trade mod, and we're overflowing. This is the new JFK show, number 88. Glad we're back in full swing, fellas. We'll see you next week. Good job.